Welcome to Decoding the Customer, a podcast about customer experience and how to realize customer-centric change in today's dynamic business world. I'm Julia Ahlfeldt, certified customer experience professional, business advisor, and your host as we explore topics, trends, and best practices that are enabling brands to thrive in the age of the customer. Thanks so much for tuning in today. Before we dive into this episode on how data analytics play a critical role in helping B2B organizations manage customer relationships, I have some exciting news to share with you about the show. First, I'm moving to a regular weekly episode schedule. And two, I'm launching a CX mini masterclass series right here on the show. These mini masterclass episodes are going to be short, punchy overviews of key customer experience concepts that will be published each week. Starting this month, episodes will go live each Thursday. The first episode of the month will be a regular long format interview episode, just like the one you're about to hear. And the subsequent three weekly episodes will be CX mini masterclasses. I really hope that you enjoy them. Please let me know what you think. All right, on to today's show. This episode explores B2B customer experience and how businesses are using data to enhance the way that they manage customer relationships. My guest, Andrew Swan, is a senior business intelligence executive for marketing and business development at White & Case, one of the world's top law firms. Now, if you're wondering why a law firm would have a business intelligence department, just stay tuned. I think that Andrew's insights will leave you questioning why a law firm, or really any business, wouldn't have a team dedicated to leveraging data to improve customer experience. If today's program piques your interest and you'd like to learn more, be sure to check out this episode's show notes on my website, julia-ahlfeldt.com or decodingthecustomer.com. There's no question that B2C businesses or companies selling products to individual consumers were the first to feel the impact when technological advancements empowered consumers with information and choice. These changes, which happened between 2005 and 2010, catalyzed the shift in power from companies to consumers and gave rise to what we now call the age of the customer. Brands that provided goods to the consumer masses quickly realized that a marketplace full of engaged and connected consumers was a totally different ballgame. Some brands, like Blockbuster Video, were too slow to react and went out of business. Others, like Netflix and Starbucks, embraced the change and have thrived. The impact has been slower to arrive in the business-to-business realm, but organizations selling enterprise-level products and services are now feeling the change and responding. Individuals don't check their consumer expectations at the parking lot before they go into work. To the contrary, they take these expectations with them into their professional lives. Combine this with the global marketplace where companies can source expertise from anywhere in the world, and you have a recipe for disruption. To survive and thrive, B2B companies have embraced many of the same customer-centric business practices that their B2C counterparts have. For a lot of organizations, their CX evolution starts with understanding data and turning insights into actionable change that enable great customer experiences. And that's what Andrew and I unpacked in our conversation, how a world-renowned professional services firm leverages data to achieve its mission of service excellence to its clients. As I mentioned in my intro, Andrew Swan is the Senior Business Intelligence Executive for Marketing and Business Development at the law firm White & Case. He's based in New York, but the firm has offices around the globe and has built a reputation as an industry leader, helping companies, governments, and financial institutions navigate their most complex legal challenges. The firm was founded in 1901, and they've kept pace with the evolving needs of the business world while remaining firmly rooted in their client service principles. Andrew received his bachelor's degree from the NYU Stern School of Business and has been with White & Case since 2009. He joined the firm as a data analyst and now leads the business intelligence and data analytics team that supports the organization's client relationship strategy. Hi, Andrew. Thanks so much for joining me for this episode of Decoding the Customer.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
When people think about customer experience, they might think immediately about consumer experiences, but companies like law firms also provide experiences to enterprise-level customers. I suppose that you could say client in this case. And in this instance, the customer is a business, not an individual. And this doesn't mean that the customer experience is any less important. And in fact, I think that some might even argue that the customer experience is even more important in a B2B setting. From your perspective, how is client relationship management in a B2B context different than customer relationship management in a B2C context?
Well, I've spent the vast majority of my career on the B2B side, so I won't purport to be an expert on the B2C side, but I think from my perspective, from a professional services perspective, we're looking to really build and nurture deep, long-term client relationships. So really build up that idea, that reputation as a trusted advisor. We're seeking to build long-term partnerships, often working towards specific goals with our clients, whether that be in the actual practice side or through some of our global citizenship initiatives, but really be there for clients as that trusted advisor. And I think, again, from my perspective, that B2C world feels almost like it's more transactional. So bringing customers along that journey and getting to the next sale. Whereas new engagements from our perspective are really all about being there for the client at the right place at the right time. The buying motivation, I think, is a little bit different when we talk about professional services in the B2B context. So that's really the big one. We're looking to build longer term relationships versus more focused on getting to that next sale and really being a partner with our B2B customers.
And I'd imagine too that in a B2B context, the types of purchase decisions that customers are making, they're more sort of mission critical, whereas in a B2C context, in a consumer context, the decisions might not necessarily be so mission critical. You might really want that Apple Watch, but is it going to define the success or failure of your existence? Maybe not, but you know, in the context of purchasing legal services or other kinds of B2B services, you might be buying a service that could define the long-term viability of your business.
Yeah, absolutely. I think broadly speaking, the motivation for buyers in professional services is about gaining a competitive advantage or mitigating a risk, or in many cases, it's both. And that really emphasizes the challenge we have to build that level of trust, not just with clients, but also potential clients when they're faced with these high-pressure, time-sensitive decisions about these mission-critical issues. Are they comfortable that we're a provider that's able to deliver? So we do a lot of work on building our identity as a global law firm, innovative lawyers, working on complex matters, and really focusing on getting that message out through all of our channels and across our client journey and the journey of potential clients as well. But yeah, I certainly agree. It's that mission critical aspect, really looking to move their business forward. And for the clients that we're interested in working with and think we can help the most, these are some of the most complex legal problems that are facing these industries.
And I would imagine too, in some cases, the buyer is buying something that they're not an expert in themselves. So if you're, for example, selling a service to a company that has an in-house legal counsel, yes, then you've got an expert buyer who might be quite informed. But otherwise, the business could be saying, right, okay, we need to mitigate this risk, but we're not experts in it. So we want to call on a trusted partner, and they really need to be able to have that trust.
Yeah, I agree. I think that's one of the unique things in the legal world. The buyers aren't standardized. So we see a really broad spectrum within our clients. Many of our clients have really highly optimized internal legal departments that are building out best practice processes, that are scaling those capabilities in-house, that gives them more efficiency and a better strategic view when they're dealing with their law firms. They implement plans like panels where they identify a small number of law firms that will be eligible for new work as it comes into play. So that's a very different experience from maybe a smaller company or a company that's been hyper-focused on the specifics of their business and comes up with a legal problem. And as you said, maybe that purchaser doesn't have the expertise in that area or doesn't have the expertise in managing the process to gain that expertise. So being able to come to a potential client like that, showing that we have a credible presence in the market, that we have a strong reputation, that we've built strong relationships with companies that are similar to theirs. That's really going to help us move that potential client along the steps of that journey and making a purchasing decision with us, but really about expressing the principles that we hold, who we are, what we can do, and making sure that that message is consistent across all of our channels and our touch points is what's going to help us with that broad spectrum of potential buyers within our client organization.
So that's interesting. It sounds like you have a couple of different, if I can call them segments, with possibly very different client relationship management needs in terms of handholding versus being the trusted partner on an equal playing field with internal experts.
Yeah, it is a really broad spectrum, and we do our best to segment them internally. So we've really evolved over the last several years to take more of an account-based view of the marketing activities that we do. So that's the start and end points of our customer journey, while in the middle is that service delivery piece of it. So I think there's a lot of areas that we have to be cognizant of what that experience looks like. But at the end of the day, the people that are selling our products and services are also the ones that are completing that product or service. So they have to come off as credible in pitch meetings, show that they have an understanding of the client's business, and again, build trust. And I think depending on the type of client we're looking at, the amount of time we've had to build that trust, the types of engagements we've done to build that trust, or the communications and engagement we've had with a prospective client expands and contracts based on the type of client we're working with. So we do have to be in tune specifically to the client's needs, the environment they're operating in, what does their in-house legal department look like, and really make sure that we're doing a good job of crafting our messages about our capabilities to build that sense of trust and come off as a credible advisor.
What factors do you think influence the client journey or client life cycle in your sector? How do the top law firms that are out there plan and manage for evolving client needs?
I mentioned that account-based view that I think an expanding number of professional services firms are embracing, and certainly in the legal world as well. And that's really about helping our internal teams marshal the right resources and drive consistent service. So one of the key points for us is client feedback. Surprisingly enough, this wasn't a big area of focus for us 5 to 7 years ago. But as we've taken this more account-based view, as we've built up our level of resources and infrastructure, it's become a really key part of driving a positive experience for our clients and prospective clients. So it's a great area for us to learn. Again, with the connection between our practitioners and the clients, they're doing the business development, they're doing the selling, and they're also doing the work. It's a great way to get a view of that. But in terms of the factors that are influencing it, it's a lot of the factors that are influencing other industries. Rapidly changing market conditions, rapidly changing economic conditions, certainly pressure from buyers on things like price and efficiency, the use of technology and how we're being responsive to our clients' needs there. So really, I think that account-based view gets us closer to those clients, focuses our teams internally on those clients, and makes us better listeners and allows us to better ingest a lot of the information we're getting from our clients and really fill out that view of what it's like to be them in the process. And then one of our big challenges there is just scaling that learning, but really focusing on those clients that are best matched to our capabilities and making sure that we're really spreading that understanding throughout all of our broad-based support teams.
An account-based system sounds like it has a lot of advantages in your sector, but it also comes with some inherent risks also, because with the account-based system, those relationships are really based on individuals, and those individuals can change law firms. They can leave. They can go somewhere else. What do law firms do to mitigate that?
This is really about succession planning for us, but certainly speaks to how we deliver services on a day-to-day basis. As a firm, we're really set up and we want to work on the most complex issues. So that involves a lot of cross-border matters, whether those are transactions or disputes. And that by necessity means we have broad teams of lawyers working on those matters. And there's often client contacts in different regions that we need to manage. So although we do focus on making sure that there's a single point of contact for a lot of these relationships, we really focus internally on making sure that we're utilizing the lawyers we have in the places where the client is to deliver that service. And that really speaks to this idea of delivering one firm that we focus on a lot. We want to be able to deliver services in a variety of different markets and across a variety of different practices, but it has to feel the same each time. So we do a lot of communication internally, a lot of training internally about our client service principles so that we can deliver that same service to a client in many different markets. And I think that helps us mitigate some of that key person risk. So it's not simply just a matter of the lead partner on a relationship leaving and taking that business with them. We want White & Case to be seen as the trusted advisor because we can deliver everywhere we are rather than the feeling from the client that this one partner is key to their long-term success.
That's interesting. So B2B customer experience, we oftentimes in the customer experience world think about it as a village of stakeholders working with another village of stakeholders. And if that village isn't coordinated and not working in unity, then the relationships become based on a one-to-one relationship. But if you can create that unity, then you can have this relationship that is more than just about one person to one person. It's about two brands supporting each other.
Yeah, I think it's something that we're really proud of. We identified our client service principles some time ago. We've had them in place for quite a while. So we understood that as our offices grew, we grew geographically and we grew into different industries and practices, that it was important that we were able to convey who we are in the same language and have that experience feel similar across those new business lines. So I give the firm a lot of credit for not only putting it out there on our website, but it's in all of our pitch materials, but also really backing that up. We have a lot of internal communications and discussion around these client principles, their key features, and a lot of our update calls and town halls that we do with our employees. With the employee engagement piece, it really helps solidify this idea that we are one firm, that we can deliver the services and the advice that our clients need really anywhere that they are in the world. And I think it sets us apart in the market a lot. It was based off of client feedback that we started looking at this. But I think the firm has accepted and the people that work at the firm has accepted that this is a real value add for us. So if we can be joined up, it gives us the opportunity to work on all that complex work that we're looking for, because it does provide a bit of a foundation for us, a bit of a backup to say, yes, we are able to deliver the White & Case experience, regardless of the issues involved in the work.
I think that that's really great. The leading brands that are out there delivering top-class customer experiences are those that are very clear with teams about their values and their purpose and their mission statement. And it's much more than something that's just written on a wall. It's something that is baked into the operations of the organization and how people communicate and how they work together and ongoing training and things like that. And it's really important because then you don't have to run around policing people. You know that they're doing the right thing.
Yeah, I definitely think it's one of our biggest assets. We have a clearly articulated strategy. We have clearly articulated client service principles. So with that as our target, it gives everyone in the firm a really clear idea of what we're expected to deliver. So we can tell that to our clients and then we turn around and say, okay, it's incumbent upon us to make that happen. And if you don't have that strategy up top, if it's not well communicated, if it's not really ingrained in the culture, people don't really know where to shoot for. They don't have that target. They don't have that ethos for really driving a lot of the innovative initiatives that they'd like to look at through customer experience or service delivery, things like that. So I think it's really important, and I'm really glad that we have it at White & Case, a clearly articulated strategy that we can use as a framework for the activities that we put out there in the market and do operationally internally.
Hey there, podcast listener. I hope that you're enjoying my interview with Andrew Swan. We'll get back to our conversation in just a minute, but I wanted to quickly share some more really exciting news about the podcast with you. The program has gotten its first sponsor. CX University has long been a supporter of the customer experience profession. Coming on board as a sponsor of the show demonstrates their commitment to learning and knowledge sharing within the customer experience community. I'm quite excited about their sponsorship and eager to share details about their unique value add with you, my listener. CX University is a leader in education and continued learning for customer experience practitioners. They have a really fantastic array of online courses, CCXP practice tests, webinars, instructor-led training, e-learning, and custom modules. CX University is a CXPA authorized resource and training provider, meaning that their materials have been reviewed and vetted by the CXPA. And CX University also provides the option to earn 6 college credits through their courses. They have a flexible and affordable monthly subscription model and have offered an exclusive discount to listeners of this show. So stay tuned, as I'll be sharing those details with you at the end of the episode. Now, back to my conversation with Andrew. So earlier you mentioned that feedback is a really important part of the evolution of your client journey. How do you go about collecting feedback?
It's been a tricky proposition for us. We started doing specific programs a couple of years ago, and the first forays into it, we had a facilitator. So we used a third-party facilitator for that to engage with our clients from a disinterested party standpoint, because again, it's a relationship-based business. And if we're going in there and we're just saying, how do we do? And relationships with the people at the client may cloud the feedback that we get if it's on a face-to-face basis. So we started out with facilitated programs by a third party. We got a lot of our internal executives involved from the business development side, our chief marketing officer, getting our chairman involved in a lot of these discussions, because it was important that this didn't feel like a frivolous exercise. It was important that our clients knew that we were taking it seriously. Some of our highest value internal people were coming to these meetings, doing a really good job of listening, and then bringing that back to the client to test it and make sure that we got the right responses. So initial surveys facilitated, and then following up with high-level discussions, identifying the right people at the client to make sure that we were getting the feedback in a way that was going to be additive to our understanding and certainly not disruptive or negative to the relationship and reputation that we've built with the client.
That's excellent. It's great to hear that you guys have taken that feedback gathering and turned it into an opportunity to engage with clients. I think many businesses miss out on that. They see these as two separate things. So they'll say, right, well, I'll send out the survey or I'll do the call to gather the feedback. And it's all about getting the information from the client. But it's a touch point. It's a time when you're interacting with the client. It's an opportunity to build and foster that relationship. And if you can then circle back with the customer and let them know that they've been heard, it's wonderful. Customers love that. There's a retailer here in South Africa. I receive surveys from them probably once every 2 weeks. And I have this survey karma thing because of the industry I work in where I feel like I need to always fill them out. And I do this, you know, every 2 weeks and I've never heard back from them. And I'm pretty sure that my surveys are going into this big black hole and no one's reading them. And it's disappointing. And it then erodes my relationship with the brand, which is unfortunate. It also sounds like you guys have taken this feedback and done interesting things with it. You were mentioning an example around how you guys have evolved your pitch documents.
You know, I started out at White & Case nearly 10 years ago and have visions of doing three hole punch binders and numbered tabs, or maybe the client preferred tabs with letters on them, and all of these tiny decisions to put together these enormous pitch books that outlined literally all of our thinking and all of our experience. And then you get your army of attorneys to go into these meetings, and maybe you show up and the client's only brought two people, and you're expected to convey everything that's in this binder through these meetings and make sure that the client or potential client understands it. Obviously, we're always trying to refine that process. So it started to change over time. We're slimming them down. We're starting to use more of the investment bank style proposals is how we refer them to them internally. So they're punchy PowerPoints. And really over time, that's evolved. And the origin story, I think, is a little murky. But basically, one day we came up with this idea of a placemat. And what it is, it's just a printed piece of paper. And it's almost an infographic. We do them in different sizes. But basically, we've taken those big pitch books, we've taken the long-winded examples and descriptions of our work, and really tried to distill those down into the key points in a way that shows we understand the client's business. So the very first step of that was understanding that people don't necessarily have a ton of time to sit in these pitch meetings and fully digest all the material that we're getting to. Really, what they were looking for was that we understand the issues that they're facing, we have the capabilities to tackle those issues, and maybe we've thought of a novel way to tackle that that will help them mitigate risk or save money or provide another advantage. So that's really what we focused on. So now, instead of a lot of these big binders, we're coming with one oversized piece of paper. It's got our team on there. It's got the issues we understand about the market and the competitive environment they're in, the issues that we understand about the transaction, and then some of the accolades and representative experience. So it becomes more of a conversation piece rather than feeling like you have to get through the Lord of the Rings trilogy before you can really understand what's going on. And I think that's been just based on that direct feedback from clients. Make it punchier, get to the point, demonstrate that you know our issues and have a plan for solving them, and then communicate that in a way that's respectful of our time. So we've seen a lot of great success, and the firm is really proud of it. Our creative services department internally probably isn't as excited about the high volume of these things that they produce these days. But I think it's a good example of where we heard feedback from the client and we've been responsive. And in turn, they've been responsive to that as well.
It sounds like your example really speaks to the importance of listening to the customer and evolving around their needs. What are some of the other ways that law firms are using things like predictive analytics to continually understand customer needs and evolve around them? What are some of the best practices and exciting things that are happening in that space?
Yeah, I think there's a broad spectrum again from large law firms about where we are with our data strategies and how we can leverage that data. I think some law firms are doing it better than others. I think a lot of these teams are showing great examples, but we're not necessarily at the level of target. The classic example I always heard about was that the various types of advertising can tell you if a woman's pregnant or not. So they're taking all of the activity of being in the store, what they've bought, internet searches, all the data they have available. And they've said, okay, this household is likely to start buying diapers soon, so let's send them a coupon. So I don't think we're anywhere near that, but there are firms that are starting to poke at these things. The example of DLA Piper, they're using predictive analytics to drive a client retention program. So looking at the key activities they can take to improve that client retention for their most significant clients. And they're looking at things like touch points on marketing. So have they been invited to an event? What's the size of the team that's serving that group? And I think you would find pockets of that in White & Case, but in terms of scaling that right now, we're not quite there. But we're, I think, starting to get to where the B2C world was several years ago. So starting to set analytics strategies, starting to really define the questions that we're looking to answer, and then looking at our data and saying, what do we have available? Is our data capable of answering these questions? If not, where can we get that data? And then how can we transform that into insights? So again, I think there's some firms that have committed to specific work streams like the predictive analytics at DLA or data innovation at some other firms. But broadly speaking, we're all trying to get our ducks in a row, understand that journey a little bit better, and make sure we're pointing our data assets and our technology strategy at improving our ability to understand that and then scale those insights across the firm.
I imagine it's difficult in a space where some of the interactions are trackable and some of them aren't. So you have to accept the fact that you have some data blind spots. You've got some areas where you really know what's going on and other areas where you might have to collect that data very manually. I was just having a conversation the other day with somebody in the retail sector around this, around how if the experience isn't happening online, then if it's happening in store, unless you've got the Internet of Things floor tiles that can sense sort of where people are walking and stepping or smart tags or whatever, the in-store experience is actually very difficult to measure. And I would imagine in a professional services context, yes, email interactions, things like that, you can absolutely track, but those face-to-face interactions, which are perhaps the most important maybe, would actually be very difficult to measure.
Absolutely. Those face-to-face ones are kind of a key component of our client service, right? It's a relationship business. We want the client to feel our presence, understand that we're there. So we reach out obviously through our traditional digital channels, but there's a key component of that, of an attorney picking up the phone, calling a client and having a conversation. We try and capture when those things happen. So we at least have an idea of what the cadence of contact is or the overall volume of contact, and try and synthesize that with some of our other data sources to gain some insights about where we are. But it remains a data capture challenge.
You don't want to get too big brother with it either, you know?
No, absolutely not. We saw a cool demo of an Outlook-based tool that really prompts people to identify the high-value contacts and then tells them, okay, you haven't contacted these people in a certain amount of time, and drove a traditional sales contact cycle through that. And it was all based on crawling through the Outlook inbox. And everybody in marketing was like, this is awesome. And everyone on the legal side was like, this is creepy.
Yeah.
So we do have to find that happy balance where marketing is being additive to our practitioners and saying, hey, here are some people that you should contact because they are part of XYZ strategy or objective for the client account plan and things like that. But we also have to let attorneys do what they do. And part of that is keeping that contact with clients. And then we need to find ways of getting that data in and ingesting it within marketing and BD and hopefully using that to build out a more complete view of that client relationship. You know, it's one that we try and communicate about all the time and are constantly looking to improve on.
Well, confidentiality and trust is actually core to the value proposition in the legal field. You can't erode that. That's something that's really important. And I think if left to their own devices, most marketers would want so much data that they would be like, yeah, whatever, let's go creepy with it and get everything. But, you know, in reality, if you do that and you know so much about the customer relationship, but you scare them away because you've creeped them out, then you're kind of defeating the purpose. So in general, in your field, what types of data do you find most helpful for tracking relationships and understanding the experience?
So certainly from the account-based perspective, we're looking at account coverage. So looking at mapping accounts, identifying key stakeholders and whether we have relationships or have engaged with those key stakeholders is a big one for us. Because once we have that map, we can really think about opportunities to expand that map or specific initiatives to improve engagement from various pieces on that map. So account mapping is a big area for us. We try and get a bit more esoteric than that. We talk about advocacy a lot. So are clients or potential clients speaking at events that we're sponsoring? Are they partnering with us on thought leadership? Are they providing references for us to other clients? Things like that. I think in a perfect world, we'd start getting to that customer loyalty or client loyalty, net promoter score style kind of thing. But that's still kind of a pie in the sky situation. We also talk a lot about reputation broadly in the market. So that's going to bolster our current relationships and give us an advantage for potential relationships. And that's looking at social media engagement, looking at brand perception studies across some key buying markets for us. We look at things like media mentions. So this idea of sort of our tier one media mentions, and then who's consuming the thought leadership that we're putting out. And so we're pulling in information from our website, which unfortunately doesn't give us individual data as much as my marketing team would like to. We have a couple of other content distribution platforms. We have our M&A Explorer, which is actually a really cool tool that we've done in partnership with MergerMarket, the data provider. And basically, we've set up a portal where people can come and they can build graphs and visualizations about the state of the M&A market across geographies, across industries. We have some pre-built graphs that look at larger trends. So it's really an information portal for clients and potential clients to help us communicate our expertise in the M&A market. We back that up with a lot of thought leadership content that's punchier and is being distributed more regularly, but we're pulling in subscriber information from there. So we're getting people to fill out forms. We're gathering a lot of our key data points there. So it's a limited subscriber base, but it's especially relevant for some of our key practice areas and key accounts that we know that some of the people that we've identified in that account mapping are engaging with that tool. We're using that to sort of broadly assess the impact on relationships and reputation with those clients and potential clients, which I think go beyond a lot of really technical and quantitative data that might be more of a focus on the B2C side.
So what you've just described to me sounds quite robust in terms of the breadth of scope of the types of data that you guys bring in. How do you guys bring that all together? It sounds like it sits in different systems.
Yeah, absolutely. So we're really at the early stages of looking at how we integrate all of that information and how we scale the production of insights out of that data. So we have a variety of business development teams covering our industries and our practices and our regions. And some are better set up right now in terms of infrastructure and resources to gather this information. And so there's still a lot of manual effort happening in terms of synthesizing it and trying to pull those insights out and then operationalize those insights. But the groundswell is happening as sort of the central operations team. We're looking at that and saying, okay, how do we pull best practices out of what people are doing? How do we standardize that measurement framework across our activities? And then certainly, how do we bring that to market to our internal customers? Obviously, the technology piece of that is absolutely key. So data integration, where we store that, how we access it, And that starts speaking more towards our business intelligence infrastructure. So it really starts with the question of what data we want to capture. So when we look at our thought leadership consumption, social media engagement, we're getting from a lot of different sources, a lot of different data points. So what do we want to capture? Are we able to capture that? Do we have a system or tool in place to capture that? And then once we capture it, where do we put it? And as we mature on our business intelligence infrastructure, building out data models, making high quality data available to the business at scale. So that's our 2019 area of focus. How do we integrate this data in a way that makes it available to the broader business and really try and operationalize a lot of the innovative thinking and data wrangling that's been happening in silos around the firm so far?
I like that term, data wrangling. I'm going to use that. Yeah. That's a good one. That's exactly what it is, wrangling the data. And wrangling the data is one thing. Figuring out what to do with it is another thing. So what do you guys do with this information once you have it? How is this used to inform your client relationship strategy?
We do a really good job of communicating internally within our marketing and business development teams to try and surface these initiatives that have been happening in individual teams. So we have a pretty widespread team, but we have regular meetings of those teams that are almost business case forums. So people are coming up and talking about potentially an event that went really well, or the opening of a new office and some innovative techniques that they utilize to build buzz around that. So we focus heavily on communicating and trying to stay agile and nimble enough to implement some of these early programs in other groups, internalize our learning, and then really think about building a large scale, well-resourced project to bring that capability and that understanding to the rest of our group. But broadly right now, it's a lot of ad hoc discussions. We've got a lot of really smart people on our team. So it's those brainstorming discussions about what worked, what didn't work, and what might work well next time, which is the state we're at right now. And again, our focus is on scaling that learning, operationalizing that learning, standardizing that learning so that we can get a better handle on that customer experience and the sorts of tactics that work to move us forward.
And I would imagine that those kinds of conversations then add a lot of context to the data, which is something that's really important.
Yeah, it was something that we've struggled with in my 10 years here. We're really good. We have a lot of data. My team running SQL queries and pulling things into Excel and doing pivot tables and pulling out broader trends. You know, we're up 10% here, we're down 10% here. But what we're really missing is that business context. And that's one of the advantages I think we have with our practitioner model. It's never too far away to get the business context, either from our business development people or from our partners. But we have to make sure everyone's in the room. We get that full context because we can talk about the things that we see in the data. Once the business development teams or our attorneys can add more context, that's really where we drive our insights. So that's become something of a mantra for me and my team. We've got the data, you've got the context. If we can get together and have a conversation, we can drive really the building of those insights. And since that's ad hoc and kind of manual at this point, every time we're identifying those insights, we're also putting that into the discussions, the sorts of infrastructure that we need to build out to be able to scale that.
And having an ad hoc approach to continual improvement is something that could have a potential risk to it. It's nice to be agile on the one side, but on the other, if a company is really agile, it means that people can be running off and changing things, possibly in the wrong direction. But it sounds like at White & Case, you guys have focused quite a lot on your client service principles, created a culture around that. And if you do that, then you don't have to worry about this agility running amok in a way that it's not really intended to. So that's a nice combination.
Absolutely. I think, again, the importance of having that strategy, setting up that framework, identifying the principles we want to communicate, it almost gives people a sandbox to work with. And I think a lot of creative people are familiar with the idea that if you give a creative person a project or a remit that's broad and tells them to solve it however they'd like to, they're not going to do as good of a job as if you put a few parameters on it. So that's almost what our client service principles are doing. What our well-articulated five-year strategy is doing is saying, okay, here's the parameters. We want to be delivering these client service principles, and we want to be doing it for the largest, most complex, and most interesting work in the world. Now, go off and work within that. Rather than just build business or build reputation or build relationships, let's make sure we're doing it in a way that's consistent with this well-articulated and culturally ingrained strategy. So it certainly facilitates keeping everybody moving in the right direction and not having to spend a lot of time playing whack-a-mole on some of these far-fetched initiatives that might pop up.
It sounds like giving that collective purpose for where the firm's going and then guidance on this is who we are and this is how we do what we do probably then allows you to unleash that talent to do what it needs to do to move the ball forward and continue to progress things.
Yeah. And it really provides the backup to go to someone and say, okay, how does this support our strategy? How does this support our client service principles? It eases that discussion. There's very clear objectives. And unless your initiative or your project can really move forward on those principles or on that strategy, it's not necessarily going to get the time and resources that you need to move forward. And we might refocus that energy. We might have that conversation again to make sure that it is pointed at that target that we're looking for.
So if you were the head of marketing or operations for a professional services firm, not necessarily a law firm, could be accounting or something else. I think there are a lot of parallels that we can draw to other industries that have similarities within the professional services realm. And you wanted to start using data to improve client experience, where would you start?
We've referenced the strategy of White & Case a lot, those client principles being the framework that drives a lot of this activity. So I think in an ideal world where you're starting, what are the high-level objectives for what you're trying to do? I think it's most helpful if that's on a firm-wide level, if you have a global strategy that's ingrained. But even if you're just looking at the marketing or business development, where do you see the problems? What are the questions you have? Is it about increasing inbound pipeline? Is it about improving client satisfaction through service delivery? Is it looking at the times between engagements and what you're doing with former clients that could be clients again? So really try and identify some of those questions that are coming out of the business. How do we improve revenue? How do we improve the quality of our relationships? How do we improve our reputation in the market? And then really try and do that data assessment. What data do we have available to us? Does any of the data we have give us information on any of the questions that we've identified? You can do these things on a very small scale, I think is one of the key messages, right? It doesn't always take a technology solution. I like to think of technology as providing the scalability to an already strong business process. So if you can even pick off one or two of those customer or client experience questions that are coming out of the business, think about the data you need to answer those and then prioritize. You can do a lot of the work yourself and try and answer those questions on a small scale. And certainly from a White & Case perspective, the tried and true way to get anything done is to do it on a small scale, prove that it's worked, and then yell and scream and shout about how much it worked and hope a bunch of people hear you and then engage with them and make sure that you've got the infrastructure in place to scale that to people. So really start focusing on the questions you're trying to answer and how data can help answer those questions. And that should help you fill out what you're looking for and certainly start speaking to a long-term technology strategy and all the other fun things you get to contemplate if you're trying to build a really good client experience view.
It sounds like I'm hearing from you, it's like a look before you leap approach. Look before you leap into the unknown. Look before you buy a technology solution or run out and just say, data, 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 give me all the data I can get, but actually be quite smart about that.
Yeah, absolutely. I think always having that target, again, whether it's that global strategy or just some short-term areas where you're looking to move the needle in marketing and business development success, put a target up there. Talk about what you want to change and then look at the data you have available and see if you can use that to help facilitate that change. I think that's really the key framework that we try and emphasize. Start with the question, identify the data that you need, and then start building out some solutions that leverage that data to get new initiatives and better measurement.
So to wrap up, based on your experience and lessons that you've learned working in this field and working in business intelligence, what tips and advice would you have for others who are in similar roles?
One of the biggest challenges that we've faced is the historical model of how legal services have been provided. Again, it's been that one-to-one relationship, and it can be tough to get people to change. And so I think I would go back to that question of where do you start? And I would say start small. Prove one or two hypotheses that you have, show how data has added value to that process, and then get really good about communicating about your successes. It can be very daunting to look at this space holistically, talking about your data capture strategy, you know, lead taxonomy, your whole technology infrastructure, it can be a lot to bite off and try and tackle, especially if you're on a less mature end of the spectrum in engaging with this. But starting with those basic questions, I think is really the key here. There's also a ton of research out there. Obviously, you're producing a lot of great articles and a lot of content on LinkedIn and through emails. So utilize those people, go out there, learn as much as you can about your space, make sure that you can become that trusted advisor to your internal stakeholders, and then start small, focus on the quality of the business process. And then as you prove out that value, make sure that you're looking at technology that can help you scale and bring that value to the business on a broader basis.
That's fantastic. Well, thank you so much for taking the time to chat with me and for sharing your insight. This has been a wonderful conversation.
The pleasure was all mine, Julia. Thank you very much.
Thank you for listening to my interview with Andrew Swan. There are so many interesting applications for data and insights in the B2B world. It seems like the law firm of White & Case is quite advanced in its strategy around leveraging data to strengthen client relationships. Though I suspect that fierce competition in many B2B sectors will push this kind of thinking to become the norm. Organizations that can gather the right data to derive insight and then translate this into actual improved experiences will gain market share and leadership as they earn the loyalty and trust of their customers. I hope that my conversation with Andrew has inspired some ideas on how CX leaders can contribute to these efforts. If this interview has sparked your interest to learn more about B2B customer experience or how metrics and measurement drive CX strategy, then CX University would be a great place to continue expanding your knowledge of customer experience best practices. As mentioned earlier, they offer flexible and affordable monthly subscription options for online learning. Listeners of this podcast can use the code PODCAST10 to get 10% off your first month subscription. Find out more on their website, cxuniversity.com. If you'd like to learn more about my conversation with Andrew, you can check out the show notes for this episode on my website, julia-allfelt.com or decodingthecustomer.com, where you can subscribe to my podcast or newsletter. If you have feedback, requests for future episodes, or are looking for help realizing customer-centered change in your organization, my contact details are on my website, or you can reach me on LinkedIn or Twitter. My handle is @JuliaAllfelt.